Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. Hello to you, the listener. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Gail Seiler, and I'm here with my co-host, Pat Schlarbaum. It's good to have you here, Pat.
Gail, it's really nice to work with you. Finally get an opportunity to share some of your volunteer hours here at the station.
I don't think we've ever co-hosted together, so this is going to be fun. But we've got several very interesting stories for you today. Later in the show, we're going to be hearing from a band called Obsidian's Dream. They are the band that will be performing at KHOI this week as part of the Third Thursday Cafe. They'll be playing right here in the studio on Douglas Avenue in downtown Ames, and you can hear them. Doors will open at 6:30 on Thursday, with music starting at 7. And it will be broadcast live, so you can be part of the live broadcast audience.
Hey, Gail, but first, let's talk about the bird world. We're joined in the studio today with Doug Haar, and Doug is a lifelong birder from Ogden via Minnesota. Grew up as a Minnesotan, and we were fortunate enough to lure him down to Central Iowa. He's the president of Iowa Audubon and a noted authority on birding and conservation issues. And Doug is here to explain the recently completed Great Backyard Bird Survey, the inception of a new winter bluebird survey, and upcoming events. We're going to be down at Sailorville on February 28th, so we'll try to leave off with that a little bit later. For the listeners, realize that bald eagles are here, bald eagle events are happening February 28th at Sailorville. But Doug, first, we've had the joy of hearing cardinals right around Valentine's Day. So, Doug Haar, why do cardinals sing?
Yeah, I've just started hearing the cardinals singing last week myself. Well, cardinals are kind of famous for being one of the first birds in the spring to start singing their mating songs. And so what they're doing is they're trying to attract the females and pair up with them. And so you start seeing them. I've actually heard them in the past singing in late January. Yeah. And I think during the course of the year, they are one of the birds that sings the longest period of the year, from late January, early February, clear into October before they stop for the winter. So they are a real songster.
And they really are a good harbinger of Valentine's Day then.
Yes, they are, especially with that red color.
Yeah, they're putting it out there. Yeah. You know, Dean Russo, our state ecologist for Iowa, once at a prairie conference got us thinking about how he got his PhD and the things that he was learning. And there was a question in a seminar about why do birds sing. And he went into about a three-hour dissertation, and as a doctorate would have that ability. And I guess another classmate, you know, sitting right beside him, you know, he was wrapped his up in pretty short order and wondered, well, you know, how could he explain such a complicated issue of why birds sing? And so Dean brought in the points, like you say, you know, the territoriality and courting for the mates. But his classmate wrote down, birds sing because they like to. So when the sun is shining, you know, they have a way of just going right to the source of it.
Oh, I think that, yeah.
And they spread their joy.
Yes, they do. They certainly do. And, of course, they are territorial. And so throughout the breeding season in the spring and into the summer, you see them singing all the time, partially just to mark their territory and let everybody know where they are. And some of them are really good singers.
Do scientists know what do they know what provokes them to start singing? Like, is it day length? Is it temperature?
It's some of both of those. Day length is probably the key thing, but temperature also probably plays a small role in it. But certainly they are seasonally cyclic, so they pay attention to the day length.
Okay. And, Doug, I understand there's a Great Backyard Bird Survey that's just been completed.
Right. This is something that was started, I'm going to say, close to 15 to 20 years ago by the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology and the National Audubon Society. and they also partner with Bird Studies Canada and Wild Birds Unlimited, the commercial store. And they ask people during a weekend in February, a four-day weekend, to count all the birds they see, all the different kinds they see, and the numbers that, come to their backyards. Actually, it's spread much further than that. Now you can go count birds anywhere during that weekend, but they still call it the Great Backyard Bird Survey.
And it's probably a good database that might complement the Christmas bird counts?
It does. It's providing a lot of good wintering bird data, very much like the National Audubon Society's Christmas bird count does. And the number of people that participate in this event, the Great Backyard Bird Count, is far greater than the Christmas bird count now, because you can do it right out your, your kitchen window if you want.
Yeah, it's a growing enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
Well, are there people in the Ames community that have been involved with this?
There are. It's so popular. I went on the Great Backyard Bird Count website last night, and you can actually look up by county what birds were seen and who had the top lists of birds. And so I found some people that I know right here in the Ames area that had had the biggest list for this county, and I found out that they that for Story County had 43 different species of birds seen over the weekend, which is pretty good for the middle of the winter.
Boy, isn't that? That's for sure. Sure, 43 different species. Is my good neighbor Cindy Hildebrand?
Cindy, yes, Cindy. I saw her name on the list, and I believe she had the second largest number of birds on her count, which was, I think, 21 species, I believe,
and
is what
so
she got.
So their home with Roger Maddox is just southeast of Ames, so in a nice area of habitat, and they got a lot of prairie. So that's good. Anybody else?
Yeah, Kurt Fisher was had the top list with 25 species, and another old friend of mine, Dave Edwards, had 18 species on his list.
Oh my gosh! Yeah, Gene and Dave, what longtime birders, exceptional birders, and contributing to the Big Blue Stem Audubon for a number of years. Well, you know, that's good that we're seeing backyard birds. Are there things that how come there's so many robins around?
That's a good question. This has been a pretty remarkable winter for robins. Everybody's seeing there's flocks of them in here in Ames. We've got flocks of them over at Boone and Ogden. And actually, they've been appearing in larger numbers just in the past couple of weeks. And I've talked to a couple of people about it. And a little bit of the opinion is they may have been wintering a little bit further north. And then when we started getting some bad weather, they started moving a little further south. And so they've moved down the Des Moines and Boone River valleys and the Skunk River valleys into town a little bit, probably from some places where they weren't quite so protected up north.
Mm-hmm. Well, and in the summertime, of course, we're all familiar with watching them get the nightcrawler out of the front lawn, as a thrush will do.
Right.
They're kind of a lawn bird. But so what do they eat in the wintertime?
Well, you'll really see them flocked around crab apple trees. A lot of crabs will hold the fruit through the winter. And I know the ones that I've been seeing in Ogden are almost always on crab apple trees, including one in our yard that still has a few berries on it that the starlings didn't clean off earlier this winter.
Well, one thing I kind of alluded to, in coming to Iowa, you were 29 years as a management biologist in northwestern Iowa.
Right.
And something I started realizing in 1985 with the Department of Natural Resources Wildlife Diversity Program was the theme of backyard plantings for wildlife.
Right.
So, when I went to college in the 70s, we didn't study landscaping for wildlife, you know, or even – and then to the scale of providing food sources on our wildlife management areas, public lands around the state. Is that having any appeal?
It definitely is. We've got more and more people interested in planting good backyard wildlife habitat now and attracting more birds to their yard. I mean, bird watching, especially backyard bird watching, is just growing phenomenally. You know, I've read figures that there's 40 to 50 million bird watchers in the United States now. Only gardening is a bigger outdoor activity. And about two-thirds of those are people who just love watching the birds in their backyard and attracting them there with good plantings.
Yeah, it certainly is a growth industry. And so when these robins are coming through, and you do see them around the crab apple trees. I planted quite a few in 1992. They're ever burying now.
Right.
Just for instance, it's in an acreage where previously it was just mowed grass and feedlots, you know, but now there's something to hold those robins.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
That's kind of interesting. So the scientific community, the agencies, you know, we try to do what we can to promote these songbird populations. Is there going to be a link to any kind of climate change issues, or what's going on in that front?
There is, and there's a lot of work going on in the ornithological world right now looking at what changes we're seeing in bird populations and locations that might be related to climate change. And one of the things that we've been looking at through the Audubon Society is bluebirds. And there was just a new survey started this winter. Actually, it's a pilot survey. It'll go national. It was conducted in four states this year with the help of many local Audubon chapters, including the one right here in Ames, to get volunteers to go out and count wintering bluebirds, because bluebirds appear to be a species that is being affected by climate change and are actually expanding their wintering range north as the climate warms up.
And let's kind of help the listeners. We've kind of focused on robins. They're in the thrush family. Mm-hmm. These bluebirds, they wear the blue sky on their backs. And there's a lot of interest in bluebirding because they're cavity nesting birds. So you see the bluebird boxes in the summertime. And for people that haven't had the opportunity to see that zip of blue, they really bring a lot to the Iowa landscape.
They do. And, you know, bluebirds, along with cardinals and chickadees, are among the most popular birds with people in the U.S.
And typically later in February, early March, you'd see the males returning. But so now there is a movement. There seems that the bluebirds are quite likely expanding their range into Iowa in the wintertime.
Right, and they've always wintered in southern Iowa. What they're looking at now and what this survey is actually covering is more of northern Iowa. So the chapters of the Audubon Society that were asked to participate in this pilot study are from Waterloo, Ames, and Sioux City. So we can try to get a track on just how far north these birds might be spending the winter. And this is a pilot study. There's probably going to be some changes made to it. This was just kind of to get it off the ground before it goes nationally. But I think we're going to see over a number of years, we're going to be able to collect enough data to be able to track the movements of these birds, of these populations of wintering bluebirds as they appear to be moving further and further north.
So as a birder that has some agency background, how do that make you feel that the ornithological lab at Cornell and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service are getting involved in this type of practical survey?
Yeah, I think it's real important, and birds can be, you know, the old canary in the coal mine thing. Birds are great in indicators of environmental quality or effects, and so you can use not only bluebirds but many other kinds of birds to determine what climate
change is. And what was the canary in the coal mine metaphor there?
Canary in the coal mine back in the 1800s, I believe it was, or before. In the coal mines of Europe, the miners would take a canary down in a cage, and if it passed out or died, they would try to get out of that mine quickly because that bird would be succumbing to some sort of noxious or poisonous gases before it took down the miners.
Yeah. Well, that's that metaphor is still applying.
Yes.
So birds bring a lot in their presence, and they also indicate a lot in their absence. What are some of the your current birding issues, what would you like to see occur for the benefit of songbirds?
Well, of course, a lot of it relates to habitat. And as we look across Iowa, habitat has always been an issue for birds, especially the loss of grassland habitat in the last 30, 40, 50 years has probably had the biggest effect on songbirds.
Are they the greatest impacted the greatest, the grassland?
Yes, right. They have suffered the largest losses as a group of birds compared to forest birds and aquatic birds. birds, grassland birds, have suffered the
biggest
losses.
Are they still trending downward?
Some species certainly are trending downwards,
yes. Which would they, for some of those?
I'd have to.
I guess grasshopper sparrows.
Right. Henslow sparrows. They've kind of held their own because of CRP across the state. But as we're starting to lose CRP acres, we're probably going to see things like Henslow sparrows and grasshopper sparrows begin to disappear again.
What's CRP?
CRP is a conservation reserve program. It's essentially a 10-year conservation easement program for farmers to put some of their cropland, especially their highly erodible cropland, into grassy cover.
Yeah. And there's some raptors. Now, these are hawks, owls, eagles, those type of birds that one of our management technicians over at Hawkeye had been out in a grassland area and had flushed four owls. And since there was, he's mentioned four, I thought, ooh, wonder what that might be. Because possibly barn owls or possibly long-eared owls, but they were short-eared owls, no longer nest in Iowa,
right. But
they migrate here. So his management area had suitable habitat for those birds. And then lo and behold, in a spruce tree, you might know where I'm going with this, was a long-eared owl.
Right.
And then he didn't go much further, and there was a barn owl.
Right.
So he had three of the essentially threatened and endangered owls.
Yes.
To the Midwest.
Some of the hardest ones to find in the Midwest.
Right there on some public lands in the Coralville Reservoir area of Johnson County. So,
speaking of owls, I've noticed that I hear barred owls near my house, and I've noticed that they're making stranger noises than usual. Are they attracting mates now, and is that why I'm hearing different calls?
They are. It is nesting season for beginning for many owls. In fact, great horned owls are already on the nest incubating eggs. Owls tend to be fairly early season nesters. So.
It has good predators. That gives their young the advantage when the other birds are nesting later on. So, Doug Haar, thank you so much for
all you
do for conservation. Thanks for coming by.
Great to visit with you.
Yeah, it's great to talk about birds on this cold morning, but remembering that they're out there and they're active. Thank you. Turning to a different theme now, this Thursday, February 18th, as I mentioned, you can hear live music right here at KHOI as part of a new series called Third Thursday Cafe. The band this week will be Obsidian's Dream, and we're going to play a little music from that band right now. And the song we're going to hear is Family Vacation.
But first, let's let everybody know this is KHOY, Community Radio 89.1. Welcome to Local Talk with Gail Seiler. Doug Haar's been here. Thank you, Doug. And Pat Schlarba. Obsidian's Dream.
Stop and miss your drop and roll.
been listening to Obsidian's Dream. Come by Thursday evening for live music here at the KHOI studios at 410 Douglas, downtown Ames. And this is KHOI, and you're listening to Local Talk, and I'm your host today with Gail Seiler. My name is Pat Schlarbaum.
A few weeks ago, we aired a segment on what happens when students' lunch accounts fall into a deficit, and how some schools, like Ames and Boone, no longer provide the students with an alternative lunch. That called our attention to the issue of children in our schools who are hungry and how hunger impacts them. Another concern around nutrition and hunger for young students in school is what happens on weekends. Many students depend on getting breakfast and lunch at school for their daily nutritional needs from Monday to Friday, but they may have less access to food on Saturday and Sunday. However, there is a program aimed at addressing that need. It's called the Backpack Program, or Backpack Buddies in some locations. In order to understand this program, I spoke with Kate Pauley, the Child and Youth Program Coordinator at the Food Bank of Iowa, the organization that coordinates this program throughout much of the state. There are a number of programs run by the Food Bank of Iowa, but today we'd like to talk about the Backpack Program. So can you explain what the Backpack Program is and how it works?
The Backpack Program is our basically solution for child hunger over the weekend. So we know most children are going to school and getting free breakfast and free lunch at school. So we know there's getting two meals a day during the week. But sometimes when they go home on a Friday afternoon, then they may not be eating again until they get back to school on Monday morning. And so what the Backpack Program does is it provides food in a individual serving and easy open for younger kids to prepare, a way for them to get some nutritious food over the weekend so that they can be prepared and ready for school on Monday morning.
And how is it determined which students get the backpack with food in it for the weekend?
Sure. We work directly with the schools that are part of our program, and there's an application process to be part of the program, and we ask that they seek out what we would call truly chronically hungry children. And so they're looking for things like children that go to the lunchroom and are eating their lunch fairly quickly and then kind of looking at their neighbor's plate to see if maybe there's something they can get off of it. The children may have behavioral problems, or there may be some physical signs of hunger, or, you know, these schools know these children pretty well and are able to kind of identify what issues they're having in the home. So the schools identify the children that they believe could use this program, and then are in contact with their families about being part of it.
And in general, it's students who already qualify for the free and reduced meals under the federal program?
Yes, in general it is. However, we say, you know, it's not necessarily a requirement because for whatever reason, some families just may not apply to be part of that program for various reasons. And so we don't want to exclude those families that, you know, are not on the free and reduced program but certainly need some help.
And how is it done so that students are not embarrassed by receiving the backpack?
It actually is one of the things that we really talk about a lot with the schools and how they're going to address it. And so most of the schools place the sacks of food in the children's backpacks at a time where the classes are out of the classroom or not in the hallways. So they're at specials, they're at art, they're at music, they're at recess on the playground. And then the volunteers or people from the school place the food in their backpacks. And the children are told basically don't open it until you get home type thing, so that it's in there, and then when they get home they can have it.
So the school staff are prepared to deal with that in a sensitive manner.
Exactly. Right. You know, we do say it, we try and keep it as confidential as possible.
And how long has this been going on here in Iowa?
2009 was the first program that we had.
Oh, okay. So it's a fairly new program.
Yeah.
So your organization, the Food Bank of Iowa, provides the food to fill these bags, which then get slipped into students' backpacks throughout the state?
Yep. The Food Bank of Iowa serves 55 out of Iowa's 99 counties, and we serve direct out of our Des Moines warehouse here, 42 of those counties, and we have a redistribution organization in Ottumwa as well. But we serve 42 counties directly out of here, and we used to buy the individual product, but the program has expanded so much in the past few years that we needed to find a different way just because of our warehouse limitations and the number of schools that we're working with and the number of students we're working with now. So we actually purchased the sacks of food pre-assembled by a vendor. So they assemble in their warehouse, and then we get them already assembled so we can get them direct out to the schools.
And you do that every Friday. So students who qualify for this and are willing to participate get something every Friday.
That's correct.
During the
every Friday.
Year.
And that's one of the things we really pride ourselves on is, you know, there really should not be a break in the service, so that it's something consistent and that they can count on every weekend.
And this program, it's my understanding, serves only elementary schools. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's a pre-K through 6th grade program. We may have a school here or there that may do a few older grades, but it's really, you know, just from the types of food that we put in, it's meant to be an elementary age program.
And schools have to apply to participate, so it doesn't automatically go to all schools in the state.
Yeah, exactly. And they have to apply to be part of the program. We accept applications actually twice a year. So schools can apply about this time of year. Our application deadline's in March to start in the fall, and then we would take applications in the fall to start in January.
Okay. So if parents hear this and their school is not participating, they could in fact encourage their administration to become a part of this program.
Absolutely, and that's what happens a lot of times is someone in the community becomes aware of the program and then the school applies directly. The relationship we do have is with the school, but obviously it takes volunteers and community people that being willing to help out with the program, and so we're really grateful to those folks in the community that are willing to be champions for this program.
People may think that hunger is not a problem among children in Iowa, that Iowa is an agricultural state and it doesn't have big, big cities. So people may think that everyone here has plenty of access to food. So they may wonder why we really need such a program. What would you say to that?
It's one of the things that I know that when I speak with groups and talk with it, it's something that folks can't really kind of wrap their mind around. But I truly know that that this is happening in every community, you know, suburban, rural, everywhere that we see that there is this need with families that just are not able to get by these days. Most of them, not necessarily all, but a good majority of them are really, you know, working full-time jobs, and they're just still not able to make ends meet. So providing this service is something that we are happy to do, but not happy at the same time to hear that there's certainly these children in need.
And would you say that the need is increasing over time?
I think we've seen a fairly steady need the past few years. There's certainly we've seen an increase in applications, but I think that's more of just the program becoming known across mm-hmm. the state more than a function of the need increasing. But I would say I know that, you know, the economic recovery, people are thinking that things are getting better. And I don't necessarily from our standpoint here at the Food Bank of Iowa think that they're getting better for everyone. We still see a lot of folks struggling, and so the need has remained fairly steady these last few years.
And we've been talking specifically about the backpack program. I think some schools call it Backpack Buddies, or they have different names for it.
Yeah, I think each school kind of individualizes it a little bit. I know Backpack Buddies was a name that Feeding America, who the Food Bank of Iowa is a Feeding America food bank, had a few years ago, and then we changed the name for, I guess, trademark purposes.
So I'm wondering if there are any similar programs in place over vacation times, or like when there's breaks from school, or in the summer?
Yeah, that's a really great question. We see obviously a huge need. We just, you know, talked about the fact that this is covering kids that get two meals a day during the the school week, but on breaks is an extremely hard time for these families. And so we encourage some of the schools to maybe give an extra sack if it's a long break. And then the summertime, the Food Bank of Iowa is getting more into sponsoring some additional sites for the Summer Food Service Program, which is a USDA-funded summer food program for children 2 through 18. So we're starting to get more involved with that and sponsor additional sites across the state so we can make sure that kids have some food over that summertime, which can be very, very hard. And we also encourage our backpack schools to find a way over the summer to continue to distribute the backpack sacks if at all possible. Not a lot of them are able to do that, but you know, if there's a summer school period or something like that, we do encourage them to continue to hand out the sacks.
If people hear this and want to somehow support this program, the backpack program, how can people help, just people who are listening to the radio today?
Sure. Obviously, it does take money to run a program like this, and so we would take donations, monetary donations here at the Food Bank of Iowa in Des Moines. But also, as I said, if you, you know, want to check with your local school to see if they have a program and encourage them to do so, I mean, that's really how we are able to add more programs, is just people within the local community saying, you know what, we really need to do to help the kids here locally, and we want to have a program like that. So making sure they're talking with their schools to help out, and then, you know, potentially even becoming a volunteer to come get the food from us, either, you know, here at the Food Bank of Iowa, or we do have various delivery sites across our service area as well. So it does take, you know, people to help out and get the food to the school too.
And Food Bank of Iowa gets its funding from what sources other than individual donations?
We write a lot of grants. Uh-huh. So we get grants, business donations from various business. But really, we do the majority of the backpack program is through individual donations. Okay. And then grant writing that we do for it.
Well, it sounds like you're doing a great job trying to fill a need that exists that people may not even be aware exists in Iowa, to fill that need and to make it more visible so people are more aware.
Awareness is a huge issue for us, and that we certainly want people to be aware in every community that there's this need. So awareness is huge for us.
This is KHOI Community Radio, Story City, Ames. That was Kate Pauley, the Child and Youth Programs Coordinator at the Food Bank of Iowa. As Kate discussed, child hunger is more of a problem in Iowa than we might think. The Food Bank estimates that one child out of five in Iowa does not have enough to eat, and nationwide, more than 15 million children face hunger in the U.S. today. The bags of food that the backpack program sends home each Friday in students' backpacks cost about $4 a week, but they are provided at no cost to the children. And what's really cool about this is that the items are child-friendly. They're easy to prepare. They include things like shelf-stable milk, snacks, and even a main meal to get the children through the weekend. Backpack programs like this exist through food banks all across the country. The program actually began in Little Rock, Arkansas, when a school nurse noticed that hungry children were coming to her with stomach aches and dizziness, and the local food bank began providing children with food in nondescript backpacks to take home. To gain a better understanding of the impact of hunger on learning and development, I spoke with Dr. Susan Arndt, Associate Professor at Iowa State University in the College of Human Sciences.
And what does research in general tell us about the relationship between nourishment and functioning and learning in school?
Well, I think the research is very clear that for students to be able to learn, they need to be nourished. The brain needs energy to be able to work. And students in any setting, whether it be in elementary, middle school, high school, or even college age, they need food, or else it makes it very difficult for them to learn.
That was Dr. Susan Arndt from the College of Human Sciences at ISU. She mentioned that all students, even college students, need food for proper cognitive functioning, which brings us to another aspect of food insecurity that is often overlooked, hunger among university students. In a recent study, about 30% of college students reported they've had to choose between paying for college and paying for food. A few years ago, food science students at ISU started an organization to address this problem. They're called SHOP, Students Helping Our Peers, and they run a food pantry on campus that serves between 60 and 90 students each week. This is their fifth anniversary, and they're doing a campus-wide food drive and have other projects going on as well. We tried to get someone to come in to talk about that because it's their big week, but they were too busy. So I wanted to give them a little promotion, and people on campus can help and contribute to that food pantry run by Students Helping Our Peers. Both of these projects, the Backpack Program and Students Helping Our Peers, are examples of people seeing a need for food in their particular community and acting on it. We'll have links on our website so people can find out more about these programs if they want to.
This is KHOY, and you're listening to Local Talk on Community Radio 89.1 FM. I'm your host, Pat Schlarbaum, together with our co-host, Gail Seiler. But hey, let's hear another song from Obsidian's Dream, the band that will be performing live Thursday evening, tomorrow evening, here at the KHOY Studios, 410 Douglas, downtown Ames. Come on down, Thursday, Obsidian's Dream.
You're listening to Local Talk on KHOI-FM 89.1. That was Obsidian's Dream, and you can hear them live on Thursday night at 7 at KHOI as part of our Third Thursday's Cafe series. But now we're going to turn to music of a different genre. We've been joined in the studio by some new folks, and we're glad to have them here. One of the people who's with us now is Ursula Rudenberg, our station manager and frequent local talk host as well, and she's going to introduce us to the other people that have joined us.
Well, the Central Iowa Symphony presents its Young People's Concert on March 6th, which so it's coming up, and the concert is called Glimpses of the Future and features two young artists. Veronica Silken on piano is a high school freshman, and Gina Park on violin is an eighth grade student at the Ames Middle School. Gina agreed to join us today on Local Talk. Thank you for coming, Gina.
Yeah, I'm honored to be here.
And also with us is Alan Henson, and he's the principal cellist and the for the Central Iowa Symphony. He also used to be the principal bassist for various other orchestras, including the Des Moines Symphony. Thank you for joining us, Alan.
It's good to be here.
So we wanted to meet you, Gina, and Alan agreed to come and help us flesh out the information about the concert in general that's coming up. So, Gina, tell us how you ended up doing this performance with the Central Iowa Symphony.
Well, so I auditioned in January to play with the Central Iowa Symphony. Last year, I actually auditioned as well, but I wasn't able to make it because of my tempo issues in my audition.
Your what issues?
My tempo issues.
Your tempo issues.
Yeah, I rushed like a lot.
So you played it too fast.
Yeah, I played it too fast last year, but uh-huh. I reined it in this year, and so now I'm playing with the Central Iowa Symphony.
Probably a lot of excitement, so it's probably easy to get carried away with that tempo issue.
So do you get nervous when you compete?
Oh, I get really nervous. I have a lot of issues with that, but I try to get it under control. But yeah.
So talk about that. How do you get it under control? What advice would you give to the next person who's competing for your position this year?
Well, I'm not really sure how to do that because it's different for a lot of people. But for mm-hmm. me, I try to control my breathing. I try to reassure myself by saying it's all right and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And well, my teacher has been telling me that it's usually what people think when they're on the stage when it makes them nervous. So you have to try to think that it's not what you want the judges to think of you, but you have to try to act. You have to play what you want to think of yourself. So
you think about what you think about what you're playing.
Yeah, instead of thinking, will they like me on stage? Mm-hmm. And then that usually gets me out of control.
That's very, very good advice.
That's good advice in life.
In life, mm-hmm. yeah.
Part of that nerves issue can be overcome just by doing it. And, you know, like as Gina said, she's done it before. So, you know, this was her second time around. And so she already knew the process. And it's a little bit easier to be at ease in that process if you experience by doing. So, yeah, she just nailed it this year.
And really, she nailed it.
Absolutely.
Can you explain what you mean by that?
Well, I was one of the judges for the – you know, it's not just an audition. It's a competition. So, you know, the competition was really quite intense this year, perhaps maybe more intense than any other year that I've judged.
What do you mean by that? You mean there were a lot of people?
I mean the quality was just exceptionally high.
So there were a lot of applicants with high quality?
Absolutely, yeah.
Wow.
And, you know, this is you really have to nitpick – to narrow it down when there's that big a field of very fine performances, but she just knocked it out of the park.
What was it about her performance that was good?
Well, as she said,
her tempo,
keeping the tempo steady this year was a big factor. But her pitch was great. Her tempo choice, not just keeping it steady, but her tempo choices were good. And, phrasing, articulation, it was a complete package.
Wow. When you finished your performance, did you know that it was the complete package?
Actually, no. I have a habit of thinking down on myself a lot after my performances or auditions, but I felt like this one was one I did pretty well.
So when you walked off the stage, you thought, pretty well.
Well, not really. I was just really relieved that it was over.
You know, we often don't realize how well we played until we've had a chance to actually hear a recording of it afterwards. You're always so super critical of every little thing when you're super aware when you're in that performance environment. So it's kind of hard to be objective at the moment.
That's right. You know, it's funny that you say that because about a little while ago, Harrison Barnes was here at the station, and one of our hosts asked him about a very great play that he made in the finals.
The NBA finals.
And the NBA finals. And she asked him about making that play, and he gave the exact same answer. He said, well, you know, when we do things like that, we don't know we did it.
Uh-huh.
You know, we're just playing basketball, and it's only later on, you know, because she asked him how he could look so cool. And he said, it's not that we're cool. We just don't know that something happened. So it's the similar type of thing.
Yeah, you're not concerned about the external appearance. You're, in order to do really well at something, you're just so completely engaged.
Focused. Uh-huh.
Yeah, yeah.
So would you say that playing competitions like this helps you understand how to focus?
Yeah, I think that would be pretty important, especially if you're trying to get your nerves under control, mm-hmm. because it gives you an opportunity to play in front of others that you don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Do you find that this experience of doing competitions like this, does it help you out in dealing with other things in life?
Well, yeah. I think that playing in competitions gives you a surge of confidence in yourself, especially if you do it right, and it also gives you an opportunity to play, as I said before, in front of others, mm-hmm. which helps, like, you know, public speeches and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
It gives you confidence and it gives you a reassurance that you can be around others.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And talking on the radio.
Yeah.
And
talking on the radio.
That's
very
confident for someone who's in eighth grade. Fantastic.
Yeah. So, were you nervous coming on the radio?
Yes.
So you're keeping a good tempo right now. You're talking at a good pace, and so far you're nailing it.
Thank you.
So you have not done the performance yet.
No,
so
not
the
yet.
The performance is coming.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about the performance?
Well, I hope it goes well first. But
are you
nervous
about that?
Yeah, I am.
Mm-hmm.
But I hope I'll do well.
Have you played with an orchestra before?
Once, with the Des Moines Youth Symphony in their Four Seasons Vivaldi String Project.
Mm-hmm.
It was a competition within the orchestra, and I was one of the winners. I played Autumn.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it was pretty fun.
Mm, it's a beautiful piece of music, mm-hmm. isn't it? Yeah. So what is fun about playing in an orchestra?
Well, I can't really remember what happened during it because it was like a rush. It was a rush.
She was in the zone.
Yeah.
You were in the zone.
Yeah, but well, it was really awesome, like hearing the orchestra behind me mm-hmm. as I played. It was really different, like with playing like with a piano. It's really different from that. But I think it's a really fun experience. I can't really say because I can't remember it.
It seems like there would be a lot of energy in it.
Yeah, it kind of feels like it. Like it's like a rush of time, but it's very exciting within it. I can't really explain it.
Go ahead.
But that's kind of a common thing when you're going into a situation kind of nervous and you're so focused in the moment that it's what I call post-performance amnesia. You're just fully in your game during the performance, but afterward you can't remember that much of it.
So, Alan, are you nervous before you perform?
No, I'm old enough that I've kind of gotten over that.
So were you ever nervous?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. But do you still feel that sense of focus and being in the moment when you perform?
Well, I hope so. Otherwise, you know, it's lost its charm. No, I do really try to be in that moment and give it my best.
And why do you find that it's enjoyable to play with an orchestra? What's the feeling like for you?
That's a hard one because it's just something I have to do.
You mean because somebody told you have to? Or because
No.
You feel
it's an
you
internal
have to?
Need. I am a musician. I have to do this. I can't explain it any other way. It's something I need.
You need to play with other musicians
sure.
and create music.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
You feel that way, Jim?
Yes. When I play in orchestra, I feel like, I don't know how to describe it, but it's really enjoyable, like playing as a one, like with the orchestra. And it's like, I don't know, emotions pouring out, I guess.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
So you feel like at that moment you're living in the world that you
yeah.
want to be living in.
Yeah, it feels like that uh-huh. in a way.
So when did you first realize that you were a musician?
I think it was when I was in sixth grade.
What happened?
So I was in the Greater Dallas Youth Orchestra.
You were in Dallas?
Yeah, in Dallas, in Texas.
So the Dallas Youth Orchestra?
The Greater Dallas Youth Orchestra, and they had a really good orchestra. I was one of the youngest players, so it was pretty scary to be there.
And how old were you?
I was, 12, I think, 12. Uh-huh. And there were a lot of high schoolers and such like that, and it was really scary for me. But the first time we played our concert, I just felt really excited because it was really, really fun to play in. And I felt that kind of emotion like we were all one and I was living like in a world that I wanted to be in. Yeah.
And that was it. This was life.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very nice. But obviously you didn't walk into there prepared to, I mean, you didn't learn to play right then. So So what inspired you to begin playing the violin? That's an ambitious instrument to play. It takes a long time to get satisfaction with a violin.
Well, when I first started the violin, it was actually my parents that pushed me towards it. Mm-hmm. Well, I have a story about that.
So okay, tell us.
At their wedding, they had a friend who was a violinist, and ever since then, they wanted me to play the violin.
Because of their friend?
Yeah, of a friend at their wedding. He played the violin. Well, originally, I wanted to play the flute. I wanted to play the flute, but my parents pushed me towards the violin. And so at first, I hated the violin because it was hard to play.
It's hard to play.
Yeah, and it was tedious, the practicing.
It squeaks a lot.
Yeah, it squeaks a lot. But I kept practicing, and eventually I grew to love it.
So now you do. Now are you glad you're playing it?
Yeah.
Do you still want to play the flute?
Not really. Not anymore.
Forgotten about the flute.
Yeah, I have.
Uh-huh. So how old were you when you began to do this?
I think I was around 6 or 7.
6 or 7.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
When I first started.
And so then you did a lot of practicing by yourself?
Yeah.
And then eventually you ended up playing in the youth orchestra in Dallas, and that's when you kind of the rubber hit the road, right?
Yeah. Yep.
Would you like to be a concert violinist professionally?
I've been thinking about that a lot, but I think, yeah, I want to at least once. Mm-hmm. In my life, it'd be really fun too.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Well, congratulations on winning this place. You'll be doing a solo performance at the Central Iowa Symphony.
Yes.
And this is going to be on March 6th. Mm-hmm. Will be the performance. I think I forgot to mention that before. It's the Young People's Concert on March 6th, and it will be at the City Auditorium. As usual, it will be
3 p.m. Is the concert.
3 p.m. And 2:15 is the conversations before the concert. Alan, can you tell us a little bit about what will be discussed before the concert starts?
Eric does a pre-concert, concert conversations to give kind of a brief overview of the program. But we really have to mention what piece Jean is playing on this concert.
All right,
she's playing the first movement of the Mendelssohn Violin Concerto in E minor. The first movement is in E minor, but actually it worked its way around, and the last movement is in E major. So the first movement sounds like a really tragic story. If you could put the music into words, there's something really tragic about that first movement, and it starts immediately with the violin solo, which is out of character with most violin concertos or any other concertos. Usually there's an orchestral introduction. They present some of the thematic material, and then the soloist comes in and repeats that and elaborates on it. This one starts out very much like the Beethoven violin concerto. It's just immediately violin.
Wow. Very dramatic.
So she she doesn't have time to warm into this. She needs to be ready to go.
I wanted to just ask you real briefly before we end, why is there a young people's concert? Why does the Central Iowa Symphony do that?
I mean, it gives us a chance to highlight young talent and to provide them an opportunity to play with an orchestra. Most of the orchestras in the state do a young person's competition. Waterloo Cedar Falls does, Fort Dodge, Des Moines Symphony. So that's a pretty common practice to have a young person's concert.
Okay, thank you. And thank you, Gina, for coming.
Thank you for having me.
Looking forward to hearing your performance.
Thank you.
That's the Central Iowa Symphony on March 6th at 3 o'clock.
Concert conversation starts at 2:15.
At 2:15 at the
City Auditorium.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
This is KHOI, and you've been listening to Local Talk. On our show today, we had a variety of people, and we'll have links and information on all of them on our website. We listen to music by Obsidian's Dream, and you can hear them at Third Thursday Cafe coming up on Thursday night here in the studio. Local Talk is broadcast on KHOI at 7 noon and 7 p.m., Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. You can listen to all of our Local Talk shows on our website, khoifm.org. Local Talk was engineered by Rick Morrison. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley.
KHOI is a community radio station that is driven by volunteers and made possible by donations from individuals, businesses, and organizations in the community. You can become a member or donate at any time, so please do it now. Don't delay. We know you love KHOI. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well, so if you would like to learn reporting, join us and we will teach you. Our number is 292-2878, 292-2878. And if you enjoyed this show, please tell your friends. Remember, your listening and your participation as the audience is what makes KHOI possible and meaningful. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.